Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
career of a key man promoting green energy in Australia. That's solar and wind and other ideas. This is a reading from Cosmos magazine. I've chatted with them. I think it's great that I'm podcasting. They're really into social media and that type of stuff. And they're also quite supportive of people rehabilitating, learning how to read things. So what I'm trying to aim with this one, unfortunately, is just to improve diction and flow of reading. Ross Garnoux's bright idea. The septuagenarian is quietly orchestrating an energy revolution in the private sector, Linda Marser reports. At an age when most people have traded the corporate world for the golf links, Ross Garnoux is taking on what might be the biggest challenge of his long storied career. Last July, before his 70th birthday, Garnoux took the reins of one of the most ambitious renewable energy initiatives in the world, a Australian $100 million solar energy fund, as part of a larger plan to sink $1 billion into solar infrastructure in Australia by the end of the decade. The year before, the Perth-born economist became a chairman of a clean tech outfit, Zen Energy, based in Adelaide. A decade ago, as an advisor to the Australian government, Garnoux authored a groundbreaking report on the economic impact of climate change that catapulted him to national prominence. Now determined to steer his country towards a low-emission future, the grandfather of seven believes the private sector is the best place to channel his energies. The stakes could not be higher. Australia has whipsawed by extreme weather throughout its history, but global warming is amplifying these fluctuations. Witness the increased incidence and intensity of natural disasters, including floods, heat waves, and bushfires of an unimaginable ferocity. Warming has also worsened the coral bleaching on the Great Barrier Reef, and threatens unique terrestrial species from Western Australia's banded hare wallaby to Queensland Lumholtz tree kangaroo. Yet, despite the obvious dangers, Australia remains heavily reliant on coal. Domestic consumption accounted for more than 61% of the electricity generation by 2015, according to the 2015 report from the Australian Department of Energy and Science. Australia is the world's largest exporter of the dirtiest of all fossil fuels. With such deeply entrenched vested interest, Garnoux has no illusions about the difficulties of turning the tide, but he will spend the rest of his life trying. No other developed country is as vulnerable to the effects of climate change as Australia, he warns. And the consequence of humanity fails to deal with the issue is very severe. Tall and slender, with a corona of thin graying hair and wire-framed glasses give him the appearance of a bookish academic, the mild-mannered Garnoux has become... has become one of the Southern Hemisphere's most respected sought-after climate advocates, keynoting conferences where he often surrounded by a scrum of reporters. Yet, just a decade ago, environmental rock star is something he never thought he'd be on his resume. Back then, he was a trusted economic advisor to a succession of prime ministers. As a respected researcher and lecturer in the Australian National University in Canberra, Garnoux was in convenient proximity to the nation's seat of power. He had served on the board of nearly a dozen different companies, organisations and academic journals, and chaired four of those businesses, including a gold mining outfit headquartered in Papua New Guinea. Hardly the profile of a sandal-wearing tree-hugger. But in 2007, in the midst of a harsh decade-long drought that turned the grasslands of the agricultural heartland into a dust bowl and forced the water rationing on coastal cities, Kevin Rudd, the head of the Australian Labor Party, and state and territorial leaders asked Garnoux to put together a report on the economic fallout from rapid warming planet. When Rudd became Prime Minister in December 2007, the report was sanctioned by the Australian government. Garnett was aware of the climate change, but he thought it was merely one of the thousands of pressing issues jostling for attention. In the course of researching the report, he had a life-altering epiphany. If we failed to mend our carbon-chugging ways, we were headed to a catastrophic disruption, he remembers thinking. The failure of our generation on climate change mitigation would lead to consequences that would haunt humanity until the end of time. Just have a break here. I had elocution lessons, as I was taught to speak when I was very young. I couldn't speak till I was 8 years old, so I've had elocution lessons. So some of that's coming back. While Garnett is a latecomer to the complexities of climate change, he's always had an aptitude for science. As a student at the Perth Modern School in the early 1960s, he was torn between pursuing economics or physics as a career path that would have allowed him to explore the complexities of the universe. He participated in a summer school for top science students at the University of Sydney and loved it. But he was also captivated by the developing nations of Asia. He even took lessons in Malay after school. Ultimately, economics won the day, a decision he has never regretted. Garnett's lifelong fascination with the region beyond Australia's border is part of what drives his now relentless push for climate protection. In a career spanning more than 40 years, including an early stint helping Papua New Guinea transition into independence and 4 years as ambassador to China in the 1980s, he has watched the developing nations of the Pacific Basin undergo wrenching upheavals. I spent my life working on the questions of development, he said, and that taught me that no matter how bad things are, things can get worse. He recalls his day as a PhD candidate working in Indonesia in the late 60s, in the aftermath of the overthrow of the Sukarno government by General Suharto. Witnessing the country teetering on precipice of chaos. Often it's the good people who give up, and that's when the bad people have a very big win. Such experience has given Garnett a special sense of urgency in trying to thwart the worst of consequences of climate change. South and Southwest Asia are particularly vulnerable, he says. The biggest damage won't come from the effects of drought or flood or extreme weather. The biggest damage will come from the destabilizing effect of unmitigated climate change when the institutions that keep the society together fall apart. Australia, with its strategic relations with Indonesia and the South Pacific Island nations likely to be profoundly impacted by climate change, is not immune to these problems. As the largest developed country in Oceania region, Garnett says Australia is a big part of the climate problem, but it can also be a major part of its solution. The irony is that while Australia continues to burn extensive fossil fuel reserves, it also is blessed with what Garnett calls an exceptionally rich endowment of largely untapped renewable energy resources. Across southern Australia, even in my hometown of Perth, you've got a wonderful combination of wind and solar, Garnett says. Up the northeast coast, even in the places like Brisbane, and just inside the Great Divide on the eastern highlands, there is a combination of solar and bioenergy, a fuel derived from sugarcane waste and other organic materials. Yet Australia has been a global laggard, while most of the quarter of the world's electricity now comes from renewable. According to the 2017 report on the International Renewable Energy Agency, they account for just 14% of Australia's electricity. Germany, which is hardly known for abundant sunshine, gets about a third of its electricity from renewables. Its wind farm churns out so much power that the state has to pay companies to switch off their turbines to avoid overloading the grids. Garnett has convinced Australia would be no less a renewables leader. In his speech this past October at the Renewable Energy Summit in Adelaide, he said to South Australia in particular could be a superpower in the low-carbon world economy. The road to this turning point has been decidedly bumpy. When Garnett drove into climate change policies a decade ago, there was a bipartisan support for the action to reduce Australia's carbon emissions. Both major parties went to the 27 election promising to introduce an emissions trading scheme which could allow emitters to buy and sell carbon dioxide permits to stay within the overall limits. In his report, called the Garnet Climate Change Review, published in September 2008, he calculated the national economic cost for failing to take action and laid out market-based policies to cut emissions at the lowest possible cost. By 2011, when Garnet undertook an update of the review, consensus had evaporated. The Rudd government's attempt to enact emissions trading had been thwarted by an opposition in Parliament, and his successor, Julia Gillard, was forced to embrace an alternative scheme, a carbon tax. Garnet's update again provided a roadmap which included a proposed starting price for carbon tax, an analysis of how the scheme would help reduce emissions. Opposition was fierce. Fossil fuel interests launched a well-funded campaign warning of the dire economic consequences. If you've got a problem that requires a difficult and costly response, he says, choosing his words carefully, some people would prefer not to think about it. Garnet, who was still at ANU faculty, found himself the target of death threats and astroturfing, slick PR campaigns designed to create an artificial grassroots opposition movement. It was a deeply contentious and I was under huge pressure, he recalls. Thousands of emails condemning the report were sent to every journalist and politician to create an impression of a movement in opposition. Garnet soldiered on, continuing to support the carbon tax. At the end of 2011, the Parliament passed the carbon tax package, which included $13 billion in funding to encourage innovation in clean energy technology. It also established the Australian Renewable Energy Agency, ARENA, to support early-stage research and development. But the tax did not last long. After the Liberal National Coalition, led by carbon price opponent Tony Abbott, won government in 2013, it was promptly set about dismantling the scheme, and in 2014 it was abolished, much to Garnet's chagrin. The tax seemed to be working. Carbon emissions had declined by about 8%, he notes, although some of the decline may have been due to economic downturn. He went for a couple of years where the emissions were falling, Garnet says, but now it's all gone in reverse. Frustrated, Garnet sought other ways to hasten the move away from fossil fuel dependencies and harness Australia's vast reservoir of affordable renewables. I've had dinners with chief executives of major energy companies and talked about what they could do to position themselves to make happen the things that could lead Australia to energy transition. I'd get a very polite hearing and a very nice dinner, but there wasn't any interest, he recalls. He began to think about what he could do himself. A friend, Raymond Spencer, who had spent 20 years in Chicago building up an information technology business, had returned to his native South Australia and bought into Zen Technologies, a company that has supplied solar and storage systems since 2004. A proposed spin-off, Zen Energy, had ambitious plans to scale up renewable energy generations from residential and small business to a level that could provide energy to entire communities and industries. I felt the company could be part of the story of innovation in the energy sector, Garnet says, of his decisions to help launch Zen and become a chairman. My motive is to provide a vehicle that can smooth the Australian transitions to zero emission. The centrepiece of Zen Energy's effort are massive battery banks that function a bit like mini power stations. About 200 lithium ion cells stacked inside a 40-foot long shipping container generate about 1 megawatt of power, enough to power 1,000 homes. For comparison, the capacity of the solar power stations in Australia raises from 3,000 to 3,880 megawatts. While the battery powerhouses may not look quite as impressive as an array of sleek, shiny solar panels, they're key to overcoming the long-standing challenge in making renewables such as solar and wind reliable. Power has to be available on demand at any time. The sunshine and wind are not constant. The Zen Energy System combines community-scale battery arrays that can store solar surpluses during the day and wind energy at night with intelligent software to distribute the banked supply during times of peak demand. A major advantage of Zen's approach, Garnet says, is that you can integrate diverse sources of renewable, including hydro biomass energy. into customized systems to improve energy security and cut energy cost, allowing some users to meet their needs completely off-grid. It works for homes, businesses, and even large-scale industrial operations such as farms or sheep or cattle stations, even mining companies like the one I once worked for. In July 2016, the South Australian government awarded Zen Energy contracts to install battery storage demonstration systems at three government-owned buildings in Adelaide, with the intention to show the building's carbon footprint could be reduced while saving money in the long term. If successful, these prototype projects could lay the groundwork for large-scale rollout of sustainable energy systems. The geniuses who oppose action on climate change like to broadcast their discovery that the wind doesn't blow all the time and the sun doesn't shine all the time, so you can't rely on it, Garnet dryly observes during an interview early one Saturday morning from his home in Melbourne, where he is on the faculty of the Melbourne University. But the right combination of diverse renewables and storage in different places can give you a reliable supply, and at a lower cost than building a new coal-fired power stations. Batteries themselves are becoming more efficient and affordable. In the past decade, as battery storage technology has matured, prices have tumbled by 70% for lithium-ion batteries. Telstra's second-generation Powerwall, unveiled in 2016, is a sleek, closet-side battery with twice the capacity of the original model released less than 12 months before and about the same price. The battery provided enough backup power to keep the lights on and appliance humming in a typical two-bedroom home. Similar to Tesla, CSIRO has deployed its own version of a smart battery system. The Federal Science Research Agency has teamed up with Evergen, a Sydney-based startup, to sell and manage home energy systems based on the CSIRO-developed technology. The systems analyse weather forecasts along with a snapshot of typical household energy use patterns to select the most efficient economical energy source. If you like to turn on the air-conditioned ATM on summer mornings, but the system knows it will be cloudy tomorrow, it will charge the battery overnight, drawing the power from the grid at a cheaper peak rate. This is part of this is what we call a managed battery system, says Glenn Pratt, the director of CSIRO Grids and Energy Efficient Systems Research Program, and Everglen's former chief executive. Everglen has an automatic system that learns that when you use electricity in your house, forecasts what the sun is going to do later that day, and then selects the most efficient energy source to minimize the home energy costs. What's more, several major products are on the drawing board or that are scheduled to break ground sometime this year that will help form a scaffolding of the 21st century sustainable, reliable energy infrastructure. Arena has teamed up with one of Australia's largest energy suppliers, AGL Energy, to create the world's largest battery storage virtual power plant. The $20 million project harnesses the output of 1,000 batteries in homes and businesses in South Australia. The 1,000 systems, which are connected through a centralised monitoring and management software, have a combined storage of 5 megawatts. Megawatt hours, I would expect. Okay. It's a power output. On the generation front, Arena is funding a dozen new large-scale solar projects in Queensland, New South Wales and Western Australia that will triple the energy output from Large Solar Australia to about 727 megawatts. Arena has also launched demonstration projects that use hybrid systems combining solar, wind and diesel to power remote islands and hamlets in the bush. Garnet has also had a hand in large-scale solar and chairman has established by the Impact Investment Group that plans to acquire and manage up to $100 million of solar investment. The fund has rights to 3 large-scale solar plants under construction, one at Catheter in Western Australia, 2 near Canberra. The largest project is a 11.2 megawatt Williamsdale solar farm is expected to generate enough electricity for 3,600 households. We're expecting 2017 to be the year when large-scale solar really takes off in Australia, says Darren Gellman, Director of the Smart Energy for the Clean Energy Council, an energy trade group headquartered in Melbourne. Encouraged by the momentum that's beginning to build, Garnott believes the dream of a low-cost Australia is achievable within his lifetime. The share of renewables is steadily climbing. There is 20% increase of wind and solar generation in 2015, and the cost of solar is expected to plummet at least 35% in the next couple of years. Tasmania has the capacity to generate all of its electricity from renewables thanks to hydropower, and more than 40% of the electricity in South Australia comes from sustainable sources. In states such as Queensland and New South Wales, though, the percentage of electricity generated by renewables remains in single digits. Garnott believes the world is well on the way to a zero-carbon future, even with Donald Trump, who threatened to scrap the Pacific Climate Change Agreement and went into force last year. In the White House, the US is withdrawing from Paris or playing dead. Shouldn't stop the strong momentum towards a lower emissions in China, Europe and other countries, in which is now well established, he says. Though he adds, the absence of US leadership might be decisive in countries still making up their minds about strong action. But anything could be less cataclysmic, which is why Garnett feels so compelled to push for a carbon-free future. I worry about the fate of our species, he says. I think all of us are capable of doing bad things, but Abraham Lincoln had it right. This will only work when we appeal to the better angels of our nature. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.